Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
Welcome, everybody, to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan. This is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
Happy Friday, everybody, and happy Mother's Day weekend to come. We know mothers are so important to us, and I'm looking forward to how they can nurture and hear more about what our guest has to say about helping out with trauma. And we know moms are good at that, but let's see what Dr. Dell has to say about some of these things as well.
Yeah, so we have today Dr. Adam Dell. He's a clinical psychologist and certified trauma expert, and he is a therapist for the staff of Notre Dame. And I that just blew my mind, having a job title like that. Dr. Dell, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks, Rich. It's an honor to be here.
Great.
So I want to start with what captured my attention in inviting you was this narrative through your content on Instagram. You present a lot of really great content around the concept of trauma. For our audience, help us understand, what is trauma?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's such a term that's pretty ubiquitous in its utilization in our culture now, from, you know, the cancelization of a favorite series on Netflix to something that we might refer to as like a capital T trauma in like evidence-based trauma therapy communities, which the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders would define as exposure to something graphic and real and threatening. So things that are really common that I've done therapy with, certainly as an active duty officer in the Air Force for almost 7 years, certainly had exposure to working with Marines and soldiers and airmen who had combat-related trauma exposure. I teach a trauma course at Wheaton College. I teach in their trauma certification program. So the giant trauma literature differentiates between two types of trauma: non-interpersonal trauma and interpersonal trauma. And this is true in the epidemiological literature for both kids, adolescents, and adults. There's that big split, and overwhelmingly, interpersonal trauma, that is between persons trauma, like sexual assault, physical violence, witnessing someone, harming someone else, combat-related trauma, these types of things have a far greater likelihood of setting someone down the trajectory of post-traumatic stress, contrasted with non-interpersonal trauma, which, listen, certainly is really disruptive. A hurricane, a tornado, natural disaster, a house fire, those types of things are horrible and can cause long-term psychopathology or post-traumatic stress thereafter. But it's really non-interpersonal trauma that I oftentimes am working with as a psychologist, and that's what I do a lot of teaching about.
You have a lot of content around kind of the concepts of triggering and triggers. Help us understand what is a trigger. Because you had, and I want to set this up a little bit, of you had a line in there of the smell of the alcohol on the perpetrator's breath, that a trigger is not just something you think about, it's something you actually feel, you experience again, and it's unwanted. So help us unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, when we encode memories, we do so through our senses. This is why, if you have any experience with young kids, man, everything's going in the mouth. They're tasting things and licking things and touching things. And this is how we perceive the world. And, one of the things that I've borrowed from various approaches to trauma therapy is when you're sitting down with someone and you're just kind of explaining this process, sometimes it's helpful to think about, you know, for you gentlemen now, or for anyone listening to this, if I were to say the word dog, and if you were to, in a very rudimentary way, if you were to think about your memory network as a file system, like what you might find on your desktop on a computer, you've got a file there labeled dog. And if you opened that up, there's a ton of stuff in there, man. Like if you ever had a dog, that stuff's in there. If you can think of famous dogs, you know, from Lassie and Rin Tin Tin to Bluey and, you know, more contemporary. If you ever had an emotional experience with a dog, if you ever got bit by a dog, you can think of breeds of dogs. You can think of all kinds of stuff related to dogs. And then if I said ocean, you could very quickly find that file. And if you've ever taken a trip to the ocean, you could also think of sensory things. I think as somebody who's in Northern Indiana, I think of seafood and just unbelievable stuff that I miss from living closer to the coast. And what's fascinating is if you allowed yourself to open up the ocean file, you're not thinking about dogs anymore. And then what happens in a trauma event is you're going through a fairly normal day and then the ineffable occurs. Like sexual assault is not something that anybody has a file for, at least not the first time that it happens. And so you're taking in information in a literally, like definitionally incomprehensible setting. And there's smell and there's taste and there's touch or feel and there's smells. And the problem with trauma-related sensory memory is because there's not a file for it, it never actually gets put away in the same way that you've already filed away dog and ocean. And so for many survivors, young and old, they will move forward in their life, no longer in acute danger. However, anything reminiscent of that sensory artifact can immediately elicit a re-experiencing event, which feels as threatening and as overwhelming as the initial exposure to that. And so individuals will start unbelievable cascading waves of avoidance. It's like, I avoid any shows that might remind me of that kind of content. I avoid as much as I can the memories that I have of that. I avoid going certain places. I avoid wearing the same outfit or doing similar things. I avoid, 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 avoid. And, you know, there's a line in acceptance and commitment therapy. It's like, control your thoughts and emotions and lose your life. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you kill yourself, but it does mean that you radically amputate away major territory of your life out of fear that you might have a re-experiencing event. As a psychologist, I think one of the things that ends up becoming one of the quintessential privileges of my career is to help someone to confront the hell of their history and also take back that territory in their life. Once they reach the point where it's like, enough is a freaking enough of this, the more I avoid, it's like a self-amplifying loop for my anxiety. In the short term, it makes me feel somewhat relieved, but ultimately it just makes the stuff I'm avoiding just rise in terms of its fearfulness. And so when individuals decide to confront that either in their memory and sort of unpacking that with me in therapy or in taking back parts of their life, what it ends up doing is creating that file, like constructing a narrative and being able to put it away, not in a way that they have amnesia for it, but in a way that they're no longer so, quote, triggered by these things because they're sort of out of a file network and not consolidated.
Yeah. One of the things you've also brought up is, and this is a similar line, is like, because of this, I can't, right? Yeah. I think you've mentioned that a couple of times. Because, and this, the spectrum is wide open for what that could categorize, right? Can you flesh that out a little bit more in terms of that? And how does your faith inform your practice? Because I think, you know, you're teaching at Wheaton, or you've been at Wheaton. I think, you know, I think one of your earlier podcasts talked about transcending your identity. So first part is, help us unpack the idea of I can't, I can't because of this, and how your faith informs your practice.
Yeah, I've been undeniably influenced by, in terms of being a therapist, by acceptance and commitment therapy. And for your listeners, you know, I think any therapist worth their salt is going to be able to tell you really early on, sort of, here's my background and training, and here's what I'd have to offer to you in the way of a particular approach. And I think arguably, there is no better research-supported approach to therapy in the last 30 years or so than acceptance and commitment therapy. And, you know, we could probably do about 10 of these and fill the time unpacking what Stephen Hayes and his colleagues have done in the last 30 or 40 years in that tradition. You know, from that approach, the vast majority of self-inflicted suffering. Now, lots of us will experience suffering. You asked about trauma earlier. It's like the World Health Organization would estimate that for the three of us and anybody listening to this, that over the course of our life, on average, we'll have three or four serious trauma exposures. Somebody that we love will die maybe right in front of us, or we'll be seriously harmed. Or interestingly, even listening to repeated trauma stories can cause a vicarious traumatization. And it's for that reason, you know, psychiatrists have a very high rate of suicide. I've had colleagues in my profession who've died by suicide. Just the vicarious traumatization of that. And so, you know, that's a ubiquitous phenomenon. We're going to have trauma exposure. And a lot of times that can come external of us. But the reality is that even though it's not the most popular thing to put on your therapy marketing page, sometimes we're not the victim of our circumstance, we are the architect of it. And when we architect our own suffering, one of the primary ways we do that are the rules that we establish that kind of govern our life. Things that we say to ourselves that we can do or that we can't do. Things that we say that we are or that we are not. Typically, these rules have a lot to do with us, with relationships, with the world, and with the future. And we live in like prisoners to these rules, like we're shackled by them. And the two things that kind of flow from those rules tend to be experiential and emotional avoidance, meaning because I have these rules, I'm not the kind of person that would do this kind of a thing, or I can't feel certain feelings. And I'm a big books guy. You know, I think leaders are readers is a line that I learned early on in the Air Force as an officer. And, you know, I think that it's really wise for us to turn to subject matter experts and I really appreciate the content that you guys have on a podcast like this, where you're bringing in subject matter experts from their own kind of areas and disciplines to talk about the threads that actually are common across humanity. I think it's particularly perspicacious for us to think about how if we tend to, as a species, want to avoid as a survival tactic, and we tend to avoid and we live in a culture where there's never been more access to things to help us to numb and avoid. Like Anna Lemke writes a lot about this in her book, Dopamine Nation, which is one of those books that I think is just a brilliant thing for almost anybody to take a look at. She basically says that we are cacti in a rainforest. You know, we are built for scarcity, but we are surrounded with so much stuff that is hedonic and numbing and pleasure oriented. And so we literally live in a culture where it's very, very easy for us to binge on screens, to binge on food, to binge on porn, to binge on alcohol or drugs, to just try to avoid, you know, certain things. So these rules that basically govern our lives walk us in these eliminative, subtractive ways of being. And they cause a lot of suffering for us. And so in the tradition of acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, you know, sometimes I think one of the really cool things that I get to do with people is just teach them how to disobey their own mind. I was just working with somebody the other day, And, you know, it's like many people will come to see us because they have something in their life that they'd like to have changed or different. You know, it's like, oh, and you might think of that as like the problem of what's present. You know, I've got depression and I want that down. I've got anxiety, or I've had trauma memories. I want that down. Some people will seek me out because of my military background for very health related things. I've got insomnia. I've got premature ejaculation. I've got chronic pain. I need to lose weight. These things all have very behavioral treatments that are effective and helpful. And so, yeah, I was work with a lot of people that are interested in losing weight. And, you know, sometimes we'll attack these arbitrary rules just to flex agency a little bit. So, for example, we'll have somebody go through a drive-through of their favorite, you know, another great book, Van Tulliken wrote a book called Ultra Processed People. It changed my life last year when I read that. We'll have somebody pick their favorite self-sabotaging place to go for food, where there's just nothing but ultra processed food. And they'll order their favorite meal. They'll pay for it. They'll take one bite and they'll throw the rest of it away. Just to kind of like disobey these rules in their mind that I always finish this garbage. And you know, there's probably a million little examples like that, but it's kind of like, how can I identify these rules and then flex my agency in the direction of self-compassion so that I can build a more meaningful life? And so when I work with people, I think everybody has avoidance as a theme song in their life. You don't have to be traumatized and have that be your presenting issue. Identifying the costs of avoidance helps us to not only deal with the problem of what's present, but I think the far more impactful thing as a psychologist is to help people to start dealing with the problem of what's absent. Like, I've got this pain and I've got this history, and maybe I've had some trauma, and I've got all these patterns of avoidance. And what in the world has that cut me off from? Like, what am I saying no to that I could flip the switch to yes on? I know that's an awful lot. I don't mean to just go on and on, but
that's great. We love it.
It really brings to the point of people have learned how biologically, I think we're waking up to the reality that we create our own trauma. That's a new concept. Like, that's a new idea that people are chewing on and really recognizing, holy cow, now what? Because mental health when I was a child was exceptional. You did it because you had to. Now It's proactive, where you're doing it because you want to. Coaches are exploding. And that graduation means that I think we're at a turning point of people waking up to, I do have trauma. You listed like a couple that were, you know, like a car crash or a death in the family. Mm-hmm. Everybody's experienced it. And they don't understand how it can be a creeping limiter.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to consider. You know, one of the things that I find really hopeful about the epidemiological literature around trauma from like the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies is the authoritative text that I use in the course that I teach at Wheaton, because it is it's more global in its scope and it's not just like based on the American Psychiatric Association. And here's what's really, really cool. You know, it's extremely common that I'll sit down with parents that are horrified. And the reason that they're horrified is their 3-year-old has had something that was, you know, in their mind, traumatic, and maybe definitionally it actually was. And so they'll seek out sort of the counsel of a psychologist to say, like, what do we do now? You know, like, oh my goodness, they almost come in with the expectation that any possibility for a normal trajectory has been obviated. And what I think is so fascinating about these international studies, and this comes from all over the globe, including kids that have been completely marginalized or placed in refugee communities, is when young kids are exposed to traumatic events, 50% of them take a resiliency pathway, meaning they never have any kind of post-traumatic stress. it's distressing for them for a few days because mm-hmm. that's just the nature of what a traumatic event is.
50%.
And they return back to normal. The next 25%, bringing it to 75%, are upset for a little while, but not even a month. And then they completely return back to baseline. So of the remaining 25%, some of them will develop PTSD and some of them might become pretty vulnerable to other psychiatric symptomatology. What I think is really hopeful about that is if a young person or an old person experiences a trauma, chances are way better than not that they are not going to develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
And that's a surprise. I'm surprised by that number here.
That's true for the adult literature as well.
Yeah.
But you know, we think of kids as like so much more malleable and vulnerable and you know, just in case there's parents listening, right? One of the biggest predictors for how your kid will fare after a trauma is parental coping. Right? So it's like the expectations that a parent has, not to be dismissive or ignore or, you know, invalidate, but expectations really, really matter. And for parents to come alongside a child with an accurate sense of empathy, but also to instill hope with pathway thinking about how we're going to get back in the regular rhythm of things and we're going to get through this as a family and we're never going to leave you, abandon you, or forsake you. And we believe that we're going to march through this compared to like, I can't believe I let this happen. And like, everything is over now. We got to take you to 16 different weird, creepy mental health people that are all going to overstigmatize you. And maybe a couple of others that'll put you on psychotropic meds. And it's like, you know, I oftentimes just think like, yeah, oh my goodness, this literature is so instructive. Now, can you take population literature, population data like that and apply it perfectly to any one individual kid or family? No, of course not. But I think there's a lot of truth in the masses of data that have been compiled. And it's a really, really hopeful thing. I'd also say, gentlemen, that like my profession is, our diagnostic system is literally horrible. And again, we could talk about that for a whole nother one of these in terms of just nothing's homogenous in our diagnostic system. You know, there's literally hundreds of thousands of combinations of symptoms that would all be different, that would all get the label of PTSD. Like, what in the world is that? That's not even a diagnostic category. That's like half of humanity. You know, it's like, what are we? So there's huge problems with that. But also, I think a huge problem with my discipline, and maybe you spoke to this, Jonathan, about maybe it's changing a little bit. But frankly, I think that in my training, I'm better at telling people what's wrong with them than what's right with them, and that's a huge problem. You know, it's like individuals come to us, and we are trained to assess and diagnose disorders. And I wouldn't have known it 20 years ago when I was an undergraduate and working in a psychiatric hospital, putting myself through my undergrad. But I know now that it's really common for trauma survivors to get to the other side of their traumatic experience and have manifest inside of them the various domains of post-traumatic growth. And I would bet for some of the people listening to your podcast, when we talked about post-traumatic stress, everybody's got sort of a construct for that in their head. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I saw that movie, or, you know, my Uncle Fred's a real weirdo, you know, like some veteran came home and da-da-da-da-da. It's like, I don't know why, you know, we don't emphasize the possibility of post-traumatic growth, but this is a theory that has been studied for a long time in many, many cultures, and it's got an unbelievable coalescence, like a really, really beautiful coalescence with many of our wisdom traditions. And I would say, especially a Judeo-Christian worldview. And so I think like being able to bear witness on the other side of the deep wounds associated with trauma, with areas of post-traumatic growth is perhaps like the highlight of my career.
Doctor, is there a categorical difference between trauma what we think is trauma done to us or trauma we do to ourselves. You talked about interpersonal and non-interpersonal. Is there a categorical difference between those two?
Well, so interpersonal trauma would have to do with when a person harms another person. You know, I'm witnessing somebody, you know, beat my mom, you know, as a kid, or I'm experiencing sexual assault or something like that. A lot of times as a psychologist, I'll work with individuals that engage in a lot of like a full range of self-harmful behaviors. And I think I would lump, you know, many compulsive addictive type behaviors in that, but certainly also non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors like cutting. Burning.
Sure.
You know, those things. However, and I'm probably not the subject matter expert to talk about that. I've never heard of someone being diagnosed with a trauma or a stressor related condition because they cut themselves. In fact, many of the times those types of behaviors are diagnostically considered to be more personality disordered than actually like a trauma or a stressor related condition.
Interesting. Okay.
Are we the architects of great amounts of suffering in our lives? And I say we as in like universal we, like, oh man, yeah. Yeah. And again, I think it boils down to the rules that we have and patterns of avoidance. Like if I can't feel certain things, then I will literally turn to almost anything else to try to numb, distract, or get away from that.
Yeah. I think most people really struggle. First, Rich and I have talked about this a lot. I think most men struggle with emotional content in general. Mm-hmm. Emotions are something that men typically avoid. And that's where a lot of trauma lives. So it's like you can just live for trauma for a long time because you just avoid it really well. That's sort of a male ethic or a masculine ethic. And what happens is that other things arise to get you to feel because you have to feel, and they usually end up being addictions. And I think it's men are struggling with how to deal with those loss of emotions.
Yeah. You know, the Navajo people have a legendary story that I learned years ago about how they discovered the Grand Canyon. And the story, similar to the gospel accounts in the New Testament, is kind of so embarrassing for the main characters that it smacks of being true. You know, like, if I had to write a New Testament, I wouldn't have made the disciples such dumbasses, you know, but they are. And so the legend, and I think it's a very masculine story. It's one that I told a lot of Marines who tend to be the most hyper-masculine of all the services mm-hmm. that right. I worked with. I mean, I was in the chair force, man, but like,
yeah.
I deployed with Marines and you know, that's a different breed, a cat altogether. But you know, the Navajo people, basically the legend is that it was a teenage boy that discovered the Grand Canyon while he was on sort of a spiritual pilgrimage. And he was by himself, and he lived in a time conceivably where the people had lived within about 150 miles of the rim of the canyon, but hadn't discovered it yet. And so it's really hard to kind of put yourself into that mindset. But, you know, if you were to think about kind of the strange mix of child and adult that a 15-year-old is, some of the bravado, but also, you know, the unbelievable naivete, and this person who has no conception of something like this finds himself alone and on the edge of this canyon on a horse. And according to legend, he was like so horrified by the specter of something that big that he must have surmised that he was on the edge of the world.
Earl,
that he jumped off his horse and tied himself to a tree next to the canyon because he was really afraid that he was going to get sucked into the void. And, you know, the Navajo people have a beautiful story about this. I mean, the people determined that something had gone wrong in his pilgrimage, and they sort of tracked him there. He had several days of food and water with him, and they sort of lovingly untied him and brought him away from the edge. But I think that story is so relatable to many of us because we will undoubtedly experience canyon type moments in our life, similar to what I mentioned trauma is. It's an ineffable, incomprehensible depth of ferocity that we cannot possibly comprehend. And what we will be tempted to do is, rather than take it in, is to back away from it, avoid it, and tie ourselves to literally anything that makes us feel more secure or safe, even if it walks us right into the direction of our own demise.
Yeah.
Well, it's a simple analogy, because you can see the boy is afraid of the canyon, yep, which is anything that we're afraid of.
That's it.
And he anchors himself to something that he feels like is stable, and nothing is happening, but it's all his imagination.
Well, and this is why I think, you know, again, our diagnostic system is pretty wonky, and men far outpace women in certain diagnostic categories. Women far outpace men in certain diagnostic categories. When it comes to chemical dependency, men outpace women substantially.
Well, you were in the military service. So you were in the midst of sort of the ethic of the military is, we have to go to war potentially. So you got to emotionally prepare yourself for that. And I think the ethic of, hey, I'm going to grunt it out and push my emotions down, because it's, you know, war is tough. What's your take on that in terms of the balance of that? Because in a lot of cases, I've worked with men for 30 years, and it can be crippling. Mm-hmm.
You know, it was really interesting to me. I mean, I only deployed once. Mm-hmm. I deployed to an undisclosed location in the Middle East for about 7 months in 2016. And that was in some ways the most difficult, but also like the greatest highlight of my career in the United States Air Force. It was a heck of a thing to be over there. And the sense of camaraderie there was unparalleled. You know, I really appreciated the teams and the bases that I worked at while I was stateside, but everybody was making a significant sacrifice while we were there. I think Sebastian Younger wrote a book a few years ago, but it's really relevant to the question you raised, called Tribe. And, you know, he has a great TED talk on that subject. Brilliant guy. He's basically a reporter that was at war with many different countries for year after year after year after year after year, and just learned what he could from people who were deployed, and draws some really interesting comparisons between like the U.S. Armed Forces and, for example, the Israeli Armed Forces. I'll just give you like a little snippet to think about. So one of his fundamental hypotheses in the book is that connection is protection. And so, for example, if you're an Israeli service member, you are significantly more likely to experience combat-related trauma than if you're a U.S. service member. However, combat-related PTSD in the Israeli Armed Force is almost non-existent, and it's 50% of all service members are service-connected with disability with PTSD in the U.S. So that math doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I'm not a research psychologist, but even I can kind of sniff that out. You know, it's like, if I'm an Israeli service member, I'm much more likely to experience the thing that causes combat PTSD, and I don't get it nearly as often as my American counterparts. And one of the things that he suggests is that in Israel, almost every able-bodied person serves in the military.
Of course.
And so when you go and you go into these sort of unknown, hairy and scary environments, and you're faced with these ineffable, incomprehensible trauma experiences, and then you come home, almost everybody you went to high school with, almost everybody you go to temple with, almost everybody on your street also did something like that, came home and has a life and can talk to you about it, but also model something of post-traumatic growth for you.
Yeah.
It's like less than 10% of the U.S. population ever serves, and the active duty service component is like 1% or something like that. It's infinitesimally small.
Yeah.
And so it was certainly the case for me. You know, you come home from something like that, and two or three people from my high school served in the Air Force, you know, and I don't really know them.
Right.
And so you come home and like, where's the tribe and where's the protection associated with that? Yeah. And then people suffer individually. And instead of coming and talking to Captain Dell in uniform, they're going to talk to Captain Morgan because that's pretty therapeutic in the short term. That's an easy thing to tie yourself to. It works really well, or else people wouldn't do it. But man, it comes with some costs.
And it's also socially acceptable to get drunk. You know, it's like, you don't need to do it all the time, but it is, and you can kind of easily hide it. Alcohol is one of the, I always love the, joke. Two people get in a fight in a bar. Are they drunk or are they stoned? And they're obviously drunk. It's like, it does something to people, and it's, but it's socially acceptable. So it's easy to hide, you know?
It also tends to, it makes, you know, it makes the conversations easier. It's a truth serum of sorts and things like that. And if you think about the second Top Gun, you know, with his name, Tom Cruise falls in love with the owner of the bar, right? And so Jennifer Connelly at that. So that it's just, and the one of the most famous scenes in the movie, the first one, is that, you know, Righteous Brothers song when they're in the bar, right? Singing to, you know, Kelly McGillis. But I wanted to go back to the Israel part. I think that I don't know if it could be, you know, if this is the realm of science or just pure conjecture, but the fact that Israel has been the center of thousands of years of absolute combat and warring tribes taken over, right? Egyptians, Assyrians, you know, Babylonians, Romans, Greek, I mean, Antiochus and all those guys. And so I guess, I mean, if you lived in like South Central LA and you're used to gunshots going off every night, they're not going to traumatize you, right? The person who walks into there from, you know, outside Kansas and spends a night in South Central is going to be traumatized by the amount of gunshots that they hear. And the people that live there probably are less traumatized by that particular phenomenon. So,
yeah, it's interesting to think about. There's actually been some fascinating data compiled on Jewish people about the genetic loading and effects of generational trauma.
Yeah.
You know, certainly even prior to the Holocaust, but, you know, a lot of this research became pretty relevant after that. I would also say the epidemiological literature for trauma would suggest that trauma is cumulative over time. So what that means is that every one of us kind of has our breaking point with trauma exposure. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's a pretty hopeful story. One single trauma event is not likely to produce PTSD. But if someone in a serial way is exposed to repeated trauma events, it just really, really builds. And we learned this a lot from the military, unfortunately. It was kind of like generation or two ago, the belief was, hey, we deployed that battalion of Marines. They came back and they didn't have, you know, whatever the label for PTSD was at that time. So let's just keep redeploying them. They must be immune to it. And it's like, after a while, the weight or the cumulative effect of trauma builds to the place that it becomes kind of unbearable and people start to manifest the symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Doctor, you're a counselor for the staff, for the professors at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because it's an interesting juxtaposition of the professors and Gen Z, which I want to talk about, of this emerging generation that is basically saying, hey, we need a way to deal with our anxiety and depression. So what is that like?
You know, I'm grateful it wasn't my first gig out of grad school. You know, like it's not terribly uncommon for me to sit down with individuals that receive PhDs in a second or a third language on another continent, you know, or someone that might sit down and ask me about the meta-analytic studies supporting the interventions that I'm offering. One of the things that I've learned from fighter pilots to, you know, faculty is that even the best of people are people at best. And a lot of folks will, with a real sense of humility, you know, seek out consultation with a psychologist. And I always just ask people, you know, if this goes well, I ask everybody this the first time I meet them. It's kind of like, whatever brings you in here, if this is profitable to you, how would we be able to measure and know that that was, you know, that was occurring? Like, how would we know if this helps? And it's always really instructive to me, kind of what people actually, you know, even the brightest of people, they'll say, I never really thought about that, you know. And it kind of opens up territory to be able to kind of say, you know, what might we endeavor to do and how realistic is that? I oftentimes think, man, like we hurt where we care. And a lot of people come to therapy because they want to get rid of anxiety or depression or grief. And it's like, outside of a frontal lobotomy or a bottle in front of me, I have no idea how to give you that, you know.
Oh, boy.
Like, could you imagine, I mean, could you imagine what your life would be like if you didn't grieve when your kid died? Or you didn't feel nervous about someone or something that you really cared about that was being threatened? Or like, have you watched the news for one nanosecond in the last 20 years? You don't think there's reasons to be sad or grieved or lament? You know, like among religious communities, it's like, this is a historical artifact that is part of what's necessary and sufficient with the human condition. You know, the Book of Psalms is like unbelievable, like the entire Psalms of lament, you know? And so I just think like, a lot of people come to therapy because they want to feel good. And I end up trying to work with people to help them to be good at feeling. And I don't think that that's just some dumb semantic thing. I think it's like, how can we as human beings feel fully, but still pivot freely in the direction of our values to build a meaningful life? And any good exemplar that any one of us has in religion or in the real world has modeled this for us. You know, like every fairy tale story that enamored our hearts, it's like, in order to be brave, you first have to be afraid. And some dragons need slain. And even Jesus wept at Lazarus's tomb, sweat blood in the garden. You know, it's like flipping tables and things like this. It's like, whoever someone looks to and truly esteems, typically that person has been able to feel fully, but still build a meaningful life.
Well, I mean, we went back to some of the disciples and how silly or stupid they could be. But I think that's also part of the beauty of the story, right? There's Peter, you know, asking to build an altar for Moses and Elijah, as well as Jesus. And he's just laughing at it. You know, it's the, you know, cutting off the servant's ear. It's the get thee behind me, Satan. It's we love Peter because he's the one who, even though he saw Jesus in the mount, denied him three times. We need that. So that's the kind of reality that helps us at least and know that he was the rock, right? And so I think having those stories that resonate with us, we come from an evangelical background, you know, I think we need those types of things. And I'd actually like to pivot into what you brought up in one of your earlier reels on habit formation is not equal to goal acquisition. I love this construct because there's a book called Atomic Habits, and it's about iterative things. And you talk about progressive sanctification. But one of the things that the author does is he says, don't say that you're quitting smoking, say that you're a non-smoker. Or if you're attempting, he's already looking at the goal acquisition, right? I am this, right? So I'm not striving, I am. And that seems to be a little bit different from our kind of process, as that we're always striving and always slowly building. So tell us a little bit about how that's helpful in terms of, because this is stuff where we can actually think about this on a regular day. We don't have to talk about trauma and deep embedded thing. This is a really practical thing to talk about, right? Because people want to develop better habits, right? They want to get better and bit. But help me flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, those reels came from little snippets from the Wheaton course that I taught in January. And it's always amazing to me how censorious people could be over like a 60-second soundbite from a lecture that was like 3 hours in length, you know. And people, you know, it's like very fascinating how people will take a little bit of content and kind of try to understand that and then judge it. And yet, you know, I appreciate the commentary folks have. So you're right. James Clear wrote a great book called Atomic Habits. And he talks a lot about this. Many of the best clinical health psychology folks I worked with in the Air Force talked a lot about this as well. This idea that when we set about to build habits in our life, they should be more aligned with cultivating an identity than they are about a specific outcome. And in the class, which of course in 60 seconds you couldn't catch, but my wife and I, we struggled with infertility and an inability to get pregnant for about a decade.
Wow.
And it was my issue. I have a really, really low sperm count. I've had multiple surgeries on my testicles, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone, but mm-hmm. I've done that. And the consequence of that is just an unbelievably low sperm count. And so, God gifted us two beautiful girls, and neither of them we ever would have expected. I mean, they're truly, doctors had told us like the chances are as close to zero as you could possibly get. And when she got pregnant with our second daughter, and we were both in our 40s, I just had a great awakening in my spirit. I just realized like I'm going to be approaching 60 years old at Amelia Joy's high school graduation. And I am, easily 30 or 40 pounds overweight. I did what every person does, got out of the Air Force. I no longer had to maintain a waistline and run a mile and a half in a certain distance and time. And so I gained a bunch of weight, didn't, take care of myself. And I had this unbelievable turning point. I lost 70 pounds in the last couple of years. And it really traced down to this idea of self-compassion. And I think this is worthy of bringing up because we're just three brotato chips here, just like three bro Mandarin chiefs here, a couple of bros. talking. I presume there's some dudes that listen to this. And
there are.
I think that, you're right. Like men have an issue with some emotions, but not all. I mean, I've never met a man that's uncomfortable with anger. It's like, somebody's going to fiddle around with your daughter. It's like, how do you feel about that? It's like, I don't know. I'm a guy that really struggles with his feelings. It's like, yeah, right. I can go to rage pretty darn quick, mm-hmm. or like watch your favorite sport. And it's like, I can experience euphoria and joy pretty quick or despair, especially if I root for the wrong team or whatever. But self-compassion is a tricky one for men because, definitionally, I think it conjures up this idea of like self-love or self-esteem or something. And I'm not promoting narcissism or like, look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself that you're beautiful. I think of self-compassion very similar to like self-discipline or self-respect. And there was this major shift in me where it was like the things I put in my body behaviorally can be an evidence of self-control and self-respect so that I can be a dad that's kind of worthy of this calling. I'm not saying that BMI is attributed to how good of a dad you are, but it was just abundantly clear to me that I was eating a bunch of ultra-processed foods. I was drinking too much alcohol. I was not moving. I was not eating in a way that would suggest that I cared a whole lot about what my health span would be. And so I read Dr. Adia's book, Outlive, which is brilliant. He talks about the four pillars, associated with a long health span, being exercise science, nutritional biochemistry, sleep quality and emotional well-being. And I can get behind every one of those, And so I also looked and did a deep dive into nutritional psychiatry. So Uman Adu is a big name in that space. This Is Your Brain on Food is a book that she wrote. Ramsey is another name of a psychiatrist that does a lot of nutritional psychiatry, vitamins and minerals and food groups that really promote emotional well-being. And in randomized controlled trials, beat psychotropic meds or go head-to-head with them. Without, the side effects of weight gain and impotency, like the stuff that keeps you pretty darn depressed. I started geeking out in that stuff. And here's what I say to men. Don't pursue self-compassion on the basis of like feeling or even thoughts, because many of us are our own worst critic. We've all got sort of a dictator that lives between our ears. I was hearing from mine even before I connected to this. It's like, oh my God, I looked at some of the dudes that these guys just talked to and like, who in the world am I? This is going to be terrible. I'm going to waste their time. Da, 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 da. We all have that chatter, you know. Also, I could not furrow my brow and all of a sudden think positive things about myself. That would be weird, you know. But the next time I go to the fridge, unquestionably, I'm either going to do something that looks like self-respect or self-control or not. The next time I say yes or no to the thing that I drink, that's either going to look like self-respect or self-discipline, or it's not. And if I can walk that out behaviorally, I get to transform something at an identity level. Like, you know who Adam Dell is? Adam Dell's the kind of guy who exercises unusual self-control in the direction of what he puts into his body, because that's the kind of dude he is. And if I have some outcome in mind, like, oh, I'd like to lose 70 pounds, I might gain weight, lose weight, stay the same, plateau, da 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 da. My motivation doesn't need to rise and fall on progress towards that one particular goal down the line. Is every single day, whether I've relapsed or I'm on the path, whether it's a good day or a bad day, whether the scale says plus one or minus 10, I get to pursue that identity transformation, that sort of evolution of myself. And that's a heck of a thing. I actually first learned that in the Air Force. You know, they taught you how to put your uniform on and make your bed and how your boots should be as the first things that you did in the morning. And there's something profound about that. It's like you belong to a different community now. You do things differently now. And we're going to help you rise up to this identity, even though many of you people have never made your bed. You're not the kind of person that does that. And you came here with rules in your head about, I don't wake up at 4:30 and exercise. I don't make my bed every day. I don't pay attention to detail. It's like small disciplined steps in that direction is going to evolve your identity.
Love it. Are you seeing a trend? One of the things I was going to ask, it's a kind of a two-part question. When you were trying to have kids for 10 years, did you look at any kind of unorthodox ways to try to help that situation out? Something that might go beyond the pale of a traditional sign. Somebody gets cancer diagnosis and there's always the classic chemo, immunology, you know, and there's, you know, hacking stuff off, right? So there's these foundational things. And the reason I'm asking you that is, I'm seeing a trend of a lot of people who are biohacking and doing a lot of things, especially young men. I follow a lot on X, and you've got started with Jordan Peterson, but then you start to see these diets and these carnivore things and sunlight and sunning your balls, right? And a variety of things that tend to kind of say, hey, we've tried all this medicine. We had a guy named Dr. Jack Cruz on who basically says blue light has been the cause of our depression, right? That is draining the melatonin. Blue light is the ruination of this civilization. And so what I'm trying to say is, are you seeing this collective kind of movement in this direction? And how much of it could be actually truly applicable to actually making you live a better life, better community, and even avoid the things that would normally cause depression or other kinds of, you know, anxiety? So it's a big, long-winded question. I'm sorry, but you can unpack that.
Yeah. You know, you're sort of asking, like, is there benefit in kind of leaning hard into the direction of these alternative, integrative kind of biohacking approaches to well-being?
Yeah.
You know, and you also asked it in terms of like our own infertility journey. And
yeah,
if I could share something really personal with you, my wife, from the time that she was old enough to tote around a doll baby, had always longed to be a mom. And when we realized that it was a me issue, there was like major grief that both of us went through. And there were kind of dark times that I basically said, like, babe, take every asset that we have and leave me and go do this, because I'm not going to be able to give this to you. And it felt like something I shouldn't knowingly take from her. You know, she had been so faithful and kind to me. And, you know, I mentioned acceptance and commitment therapy earlier, and I hope it doesn't sound like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, because I really do believe that in our wisdom traditions, in terms of sanctification, in the science of shaping behavior and evolving as human beings. I think that we can all be in a process with that. You know, we can all be on a journey with that to build a meaningful life and to show up towards the ceiling of our potential. I also think that more Eastern philosophical, radical acceptance orientation type philosophies make a great deal of sense in a world as broken as ours, where everybody's going out horizontal, you know? And yeah. I don't mean acceptance like tolerance and resignation. I mean acceptance like I can be with my life right now exactly as it is and still find contentment.
Contentment.
And meaning, yeah. And purpose. So for example, my favorite Old Testament story, I've preached a lot at multiple churches. I went to seminary before I went off to become a psychologist. And one of my favorite Old Testament stories in the world is the story of Mephibosheth. Bosh in the middle of Mephibosheth's name is the word shame in Hebrew. And this is a story of trauma. It's a story of a five-year-old kid that had his legs broken.
Yeah.
And then he lived the rest of his life broken. And the first thing that you learn about him and the last thing that you learn about Mephibosheth is that he's lame in both of his feet. And it's so amazing that David's men find him in Lo-debar, which literally means no pasture, no hope, no man's land, and bring him up. It's just a beautiful story. I've got that sermon somewhere online. But anyway, when I gave that sermon in Enid, Oklahoma, really close to the pilot training base where I was an officer in the Air Force, I shared with the congregation there that one of the areas of brokenness in our life, like the things that despite being affiliated as one of God's children, that I still carried this lameness, it was this infertility issue. And at the time we had foster kids living with us. We had done that for years and years and years. We had grieved through it. We recommitted to one another. We sort of embraced the reality that even if this doesn't change, God is good. We can be committed to one another. It was not an accident that we partnered together and that we get to still build something meaningful. And I looked out into the audience and I'm sharing this and I'm emotional. My wife's got tears rolling down her face. And she was pregnant there and we had no idea.
Oh my gosh.
She was pregnant with Amelia or with Adeline. Yeah, our first child.
Amazing.
And it's just like such an amazing thing. You know, that's not everybody's story. And I'm not sharing that to say that. And there were a lot of people that came up to me afterwards and they're like, have you tried ashwagandha? And have you, supplements, man, and like, you know, fan your balls or something, you know, it's like, you know, for us, it was kind of like, that is one of the closest things I've ever been to radical acceptance and contentment. Like, I wish this was different, but even though it's not, I can be with this and still find joy and still find meaning. And that, honestly, that's kind of what post-traumatic growth is. Like, people don't get post-traumatic growth as the opposite of post-traumatic stress. You can only get post-traumatic growth if you have experienced horrific harm from trauma. And in healing from the trauma, you might develop a deeper relationship with God, a deeper empathy with other people, a newfound set of possibilities and new possibilities to go in the direction of. These are various domains of post-traumatic growth that come after the suffering has occurred. But if we don't allow ourselves to feel fully, like to hug the cactus or embrace the suck, you know, or all these terms that I heard from the military, if we don't allow ourselves to go through the dark night of the soul, then we never get to the break of dawn, which is just a radiant light that's worth showing up to. And so this is why I think, you know, you mentioned spirituality earlier, and I think this is what is so distinctive in my mind about Jesus as a central figure in a religious frame, that he has something to say about the problem of evil, not by transcending it or philosophizing it, but going through it. And I think it was Edward Shalito, one of my favorite poems, praying to this suffering Christ, this Christ that was betrayed and beaten almost to death and crucified in front of his mom. You know, you think about like painting the most graphic and horrific, unjust, reprehensible scene that any human could go through, and he didn't deserve it. And Edward Shalito, praying to that Christ, said, "The other gods were strong, but thou wast weak. They rode, but thou didst stumble to a throne. But to our wounds, only your wounds can speak, for no other god has wounds but thou alone."
Wow.
And I just think, like, that's something I could gravitate to, you know, that, like, by his wounds we're healed.
Yep.
And in our wounds we find, you know, we find him, or something that he experienced.
Dr. Dell, we have time for about two more questions.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, what drew you to this type of work?
Yeah, I was a sexually abused little boy growing up in Pennsylvania. And I carried that with me for a long darn time. And I ended up disclosing the full details of that in college in a counseling center with a lady named Carol. And I don't remember a darn thing that Carol said to me in that session, but I'll never forget the tear that ran down her cheek when I looked up at her and found the courage to look her in the eyes after I talked about horrific, graphic sexual assault. And you know, I went through kind of a healing journey with her in that process, and also found faith in college. And it was the coalescence of those two things that initially moved me in the direction of ministry. However, a lot of people were showing up to the church with addictions and domestic violence and, you know, schizophrenia spectrum disorders. And it was like, whew, if I've got a chance to learn more about this, I'd like to. And I'm really drawn to that work. And so, yeah, it set me on a path. I was just so lucky. I was an alternate to get into my doc program, which meant I wasn't a first selection, but one of their shiny stars dropped out. So I got in by the back door. I was an alternate into the Air Force. And so their shiny star dropped out and I got in by the back door. And I feel like in some ways I'm a Mephibosheth of God. I don't deserve a seat at the table, but I'm there and happy to continue to serve in that way. So yeah, it's cultivated in pain in my own story.
Well, even the pregnancy is just another example of just an amazing impossibility, if you would. And yet here we are. Wow. Well, on a light note then, what are the plans for Mother's Day weekend? How are we going to celebrate your two beautiful daughters and your wife? What's going on?
Yeah, so we've got, we do a lot of art at our house. And so there is a carefully crafted series of cards that are hidden under my four-year-old's bed right now that we'll share with Janine. And then we're taking her to the zoo, the South Bend Zoo, which is a favorite place of hers. And then we're going to take her out to eat wherever she wants to go so she doesn't have to make us knuckleheads another meal. So hopefully, you know, nothing would be really sufficient, but hopefully it'll be meaningful for her. So.
Oh, wow. What a joy. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. I'm looking forward to more conversations. It sounds like we've got a lot we can unpack and break things down. So thank you so much for joining us. This has just been absolutely mind-blowing and uplifting and educational.
Hey, thanks, guys. It was such an honor that you reached out. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Dell, again, this has been fantastic because I appreciate your wisdom. There's something in speaking with someone who really dives deep into this subject, and it's my personal belief that people are waking up to the need to heal their trauma, and you've added a tremendous amount to that conversation today. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. So to all of our listeners, thank you for staying with us, and please comment. We've been getting a huge increase in listeners, so thank you to those groups. Please comment, let us know, and recommend who you'd like to see us on if you want to introduce us to somebody. So to everyone out there, have a great Mother's Day weekend. Much love, everybody. We'll be right back.